My name's Don. I'm an alcoholic. Congratulations, Larry. Where'd you go? Yeah, that's a big deal, and I love the acknowledgement and the recognition of the group that you're with. You know, because I can't do this. I do this in a group. This is a full contact sport, and I need help. I need teammates, so I appreciate that. I want to thank Joe and Tony and Steven for having me. And Anna, thank you very much for your 10 minutes. I was telling Marty outside, it was like 3 minutes intro, 3 minutes middle, 3 minutes finished, 1 minute stick the landing and just walk off and be beautiful the whole time. Like, sweet. Oh, that'll be no problem if I can follow that. So, you know, I wanted to try to do something a little bit different because it is what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. The thing is that there's a lot of what it's like now for me because I've been sober a while. And I want to also thank all the people, my friends. You know, I just talked about this team thing, that I don't do this alone. And there are nearly 20 people that are here and supporting me, and I really appreciate it. You know, it's like I'm not alone. And it used to be that I always was alone. And I was alone because I'd get kicked out of places, or I'd just randomly wander off somewhere, or, you know, I was on the run from myself. So I'm grateful to be here, and welcome also to our friends from Texas. It's nice to have you here. You know, there's, yeah, sure, give a round of applause for Texas. I grew up in Detroit, and there's only three places in the state or in the country that have these big signs. There's one on the 75 as you go south down through Florida. There's one at the border of Texas. There's one on the 8 or on the 10 as you come into California. It says, "This state does not work either." And I missed that when I got here to L.A., but it's nice to have you here. So one thing I did want to talk about was a friend of this meeting, a guy named Larry Lay, he said something that's been the most profound thing I've heard in the last 5 years. And that is that alcoholics are the elite of the mentally ill. So we are the elite, which is why dating in AA is so fun and popular, you know. The odds are good, but the goods are odd. I told Marty I'd give him credit for that. So, you know, if you're new, or, you know, if you're new to the meeting or new to AA, welcome. It's nice to have you here. And I'll share with you the same thing that was shared with me by... For me, it was a woman with a big purse and a big hair and a big dress, and it was in a Lano club outside Detroit, and she said, you know, first, they always come up and they say, "Honey, are you new?" And it's like, "Why do you think that?" Shaking like a kook. And she said, "Well, honey, there's nothing to worry about. You know, I got good news and bad news. You know, the good news is there's help, and the bad news is it's us." So, welcome. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous is amazing. It's unbelievable. It's magical. There are some people, you look at them, you know, maybe Anna had this experience. She comes to AA and people are like, "Oh, you're too young," or "You're too pretty," or "I don't believe you're really an alcoholic." I don't think anybody told Larry, "Larry, I don't believe you." Larry, I think, you know, you, I have full confidence that you have drank your fair share and you are welcome in this meeting. And it's like... And it's important to acknowledge that, you know, and I mean that as a compliment, because it's like that surrender is vital. The surrender, the acknowledgement that I've got a problem, I'm powerless over alcohol, and my life's unmanageable, and acknowledging that disease. This week has been very wild. First, to get the call, it was only, you know, a week ago that somebody called and asked me to do this, and I said yes. And then I went to a meeting on Monday night, and there was a guy who... had been going 9 years solid, 9 years, came from coke and problems and all sorts of crap that we do, jails. And he got sober, started working a program, started being a regular at Claremont Men's, 9 years solid. And he said, you know, life got really good. And I just felt like first I stopped calling my sponsor, then I started fading out from the meetings. And it was a matter of 5 months before I was drinking again. The first time I went, I was going for a taco. I was on my bike 5 minutes before I had the taco. The idea of a beer with my taco sounded good. Came out of nowhere. I had my one beer with my taco, and I thought, I can handle it. It's been almost a decade, no problem. Well, he was locked in a hotel for a month with a bag of Coke and a bottle like we do. And it was another year before I got back to the program. And it just reminded me of something that Richard Zinni, a sponsor of mine, told me that I've never forgotten. AA will give you everything you need not to need AA. You know? And so I try to stay grateful, and I also try to stay very close to Alcoholics Anonymous. The next day, I've been back and forth with a former student of mine. I teach high school, and I actually have several students here that are sober today that are here, which is really cool. And this is a kid that was 15 years old when I first met him. There was one day he came to class. It was like Wednesday, 10 o'clock he showed up, you know, first time that week. Good to see you, Ray. How you doing? Oh, you know, I've been rolling like a motherfucker. I'm like, oh. Sounds good. I mean, this guy, you know, loves drugs, but he especially loved Molly. So he's sitting next to my desk, and he's like, can you hear that? I'm like, hear what? He goes, that popping and crackling. It's my brain. I'm like, Ray, I can't hear the popping and crackling, but I don't have any doubt that you hear that. And I think it's Morse code for you need to quit using drugs. And, you know, Ray's charming and smart and tricky and doesn't like to work so hard and likes to get other people to do stuff for him and sweet and nice and super alcoholic and drug addicted. And so he contacted me 10 years later. He's 25 now, been in and out of jail he's been arrested 10 times, homeless. You know, he's telling me this story for an hour Wednesday night. And I'm thinking about this 15-year-old kid, and things I told him then are no different than the things I was telling him now. And he was supposed to be here tonight with his mom, and I don't see him, which is the way things go, you know. This is why it's like, it's so vital for me to remember. I'm alcoholic. I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable, and I'm no less powerless over your alcoholism than I am over my own alcoholism or my father's alcoholism or anybody else in my life that's alcoholic. And I, you know, as a drinker, I only hung out with people that were alcoholic. If you didn't drink, I didn't want anything to do with you. I didn't hang around you. You know, I was the chug master of my fraternity. I was the anchor man of my rugby team. I drank out of a funnel. You know, I just love drinking. And the idea that I would be sober or that I wouldn't drink, it just was beyond me. Everyone in my family drank. My grandfather died of alcoholism at 49. Both my uncles died before they were 50. My dad, you know, for that last 5 years from 45 to 50, every day he'd wake up and, you know, was just very anxious and would drink and talk about how he was going to die. And, you know, my dad's 81. He just celebrated 81 years of birth or life. And it's something because that relationship with my father is the most complicated relationship I've ever had, in part because I'm so much like him, and in part because I'm so much not like him. And so the point is that Wednesday I talked with Ray, and then today Anthony and I went to a meeting and we went out to breakfast, and then I got a message from Chase, who is the guy I sponsored 10 years ago, 8 years ago, who many of you know. He's been in and out of the Freedom. He's back at the Freedom Ranch for the third time. And he told me that he's got a Mother's Day dinner tonight, so he can't be here, but that they'd be listening to this tape. So, and he said that I could say this. So, Chase, if you're there. you know, the thing is, again, it's that heartbreak, and the first time he went to an AA meeting, he was 15. He's 32. He's been to 22 rehabs. He's 60 days sober. And, you know, he overdosed, flatlined nearly. broke his mother's heart for the umpteenth time, like we've all done. And my hope is that he stays sober. But whether he stays sober or not, my hope is that I stay sober. And so, you know, I'm here tonight to talk about getting sober, talk about my drinking, but mostly talk about my sobriety, because this is a cunning, baffling, powerful thing. You know, it just is so cunning, baffling, and powerful. And the suffering that we endure, the suffering I put myself through. And I can help you decide whether or not you're alcoholic or not. And it's a simple test. If you find yourself arguing with yourself regularly and losing, you may be alcoholic. And it's like, you know, staying sober in AA, I've learned a lot. And one of the things I heard when I first got here was that we'll love you till you can love yourself. And I thought to myself, what the hell does that even mean? We'll love you till you can love yourself. So stupid. Really annoying. And don't touch me. And don't hug me. And I'm not a miracle. Stick it in your ear, you know? Honestly. Mystical mumbo jumbo horse shit. But, you know, I am a miracle. And so is everybody else in this room. Every single person. You know, if we were to add up the number of hospital stays, the number of arrests, the number of days locked up, the amount of medication that's been handed to us, the amount of booze and drugs we've consumed, just in this room, to think that on a Saturday night we're all sitting here together listening to this bozo talk, pretty unbelievable, you know? That's a miracle. And I started to learn how to spot miracles. And I wrote this down mostly just to help me not get... I bird walk and go down rabbit holes like a mofo. So I'm just going to try to keep it a little dialed in here. And the thing is, like this right here, there's two things I want to talk about. One is my thinking, and the other is my spiritual connection. Because that's all that matters. So those are it. My spiritual... You know, the book says that the purpose of this book is to introduce you to a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. You know? And it also says that the problem centers in my mind. So if I'm going to understand Alcoholics Anonymous as it's in the book, I need to understand that my problem centers in my mind. I have an allergic body that reacts abnormally to alcohol. Normal people don't drink out of a funnel for 12 hours. You know, so when I got to AA and people told me, you know, you have a problem drinking, I was like, what the hell are you talking? It's the only thing left that I can do. I can drink. I can't do anything. I can't get up to go to school. I can't show up for anybody that needs me. But drinking, I got on lock. I'm good at that. But I didn't understand that the allergy they were talking about was my inability to metabolize alcohol. And so there's this craving, which is why at the end of the night, I'm going around drinking the half-empty beers with the cigarettes in them. Don't judge. It's why my friends... You know, one of the things I love, and I'm on this new paleo diet, which is, the problem with paleo is there's no pizza, and there's definitely no pizza and beer. And I tell you, there is nothing I love more than pizza and beer. But, you know, there are numerous occasions where I would be at a restaurant, finished all of my pizza, all of my beer, and as I'm leaving, grabbing the pizza and beer off of... Now, not necessarily somebody who's still eating their pizza and beer, although I have done that. But grabbing, you know, people leaving half pitchers or glasses full. It's like I'm not leaving. That's alcohol abuse, leaving all that booze on the table. So, you know, so this deal about trying to understand the problem centers in my mind. And again, another issue for me when I got to AA, when I first got here, there was a guy named Navy Dick. He was a veteran, World War II vet at the Alano Club I used to hang out on outside Detroit. And I came here, as I told you, my dad was alcoholic and I grew up in an alcoholic home. And that's not why I'm alcoholic, but it sure didn't help. I started drinking young at 13 like you did, lying, and I was drinking pints in high school. I was drinking fifths by the time I was a senior, and I was drinking liters by the time I was in college. One of the greatest joys when I was drinking would be to walk into a liquor store, get a pack of Reds, get a fifth of Jack Daniels, start the car, push in the Guns N' Roses tape, open up, you know, light a cigarette, open up the Jack, throw the cap out the window, put the car in drive, and off we go. That is, like, perfect. And, I, you know, everyone's like, nobody's ever done that before? That's a good appetite for destruction, anybody? Yeah, wrong party. So, you know, that's my problem is, like, I feel when I get a drink or even the idea of drinking, I feel very in control. Most normal people take a drink and they feel out of control. That difference is part of what makes me alcoholic. You know, the other part is I remember being in class specifically it was a Friday morning and it was about 10 o'clock and I had been out the night before and I was sitting in this class listening to this teacher run their mouth and I just was not, I mean, I wanted to scream, I wanted to get up and, you know, yell, I wanted to flip my desk, but I just sat there, and then I thought about the 12-pack of Bud Light I had in my fridge, and I didn't just think about it, I thought about it, I visualized it, I sat there, and I could see it, I could see the sweat on the can, and I just thought, it's like another hour, this guy's got to shut up at some point, and I get to go home and drink my beer. That's alcohol. Normal people don't do that. Normal people don't mow a lawn, sit down, and drink 24 Pepsis. Never have since I gotten sober, mowed a lawn, and drank 24 Cokes. But I assure you, I have easily sat down after doing a half an hour's worth of yard work and drank a 12-pack or a case of beer if I had it. So these are alcoholic things that I've lived with. And again, it centers in my thinking. It centers in my discomfort. It centers in my disease. It centers in my self-centeredness, in my selfishness, in my inability to even conceive of what somebody else is experiencing or care, particularly if I'm afraid or if I'm threatened. Those things are very difficult for me. Or if I'm disappointed. I don't handle disappointment very well. And I can tell a little story about that later. But the spiritual part of the program is like the wet part of the ocean. Right? This is all spiritual. So this idea of like, I'm going to work on the spiritual part, It's all spiritual. The whole thing. And in the middle of the word spiritual is the word ritual. And the word ritual is very important in Alcoholics Anonymous. Rituals are things we do regularly. Rituals are things I do daily. Rituals are things like praying in the morning and praying at night. When I first got to AA, I had no belief in God. I was raised by an atheist, and I really had no use of any, you know, it just wasn't even on my radar. But I was desperate when I got here, and they said pray. And I just didn't understand, and I got really rebellious. And I had to devise some way that I would force myself to do things that were unnatural and that I felt like were stupid. Because I thought a lot of stuff was stupid. And a lot, especially about AA, I thought a lot of stuff in AA was stupid. And I was smart. Which is why I had all the success I had, right? I mean, I show up crawling to AA meeting, just begging for help. But one of the things I did was I had a pair of Nikes and I wrote on one shoe, thank help, and on the other shoe, you, me. And honestly, this is true, I would take off one shoe at night and put it on, and I'd get on my knees and put it under my bed and say, thank you. And in the morning, I'd say, help me. Thank you, help me. Thank you, help me. Over and over until one day I said, and, you know, I'm so mad at my dad and I don't know what to say. And I started a small conversation and then went, oh, put my shoes back on. Right? But that was, I mean, I get very, I majored in mathematics. I'm very on, off, right, wrong, yes, no, binary kind of thinking. It was very black and white in all things, and AA has helped me learn how to live in the gray, because very little in life is black and white, especially in human relationships. You know, relationships are very nuanced and complicated. Working with my mind, which is where the problem centers, is nuanced and complicated. I try to push, and all of a sudden, there's this huge pushback. I try to quit something, and I do it five times worse the next day. And I've struggled with everything there is to struggle with. I've struggled with cigarettes. We were talking on the way out here. Started smoking when I was 13. Quit smoking when I was 23. After a year of trying to quit smoking, started smoking again. I had a Cuban cigar down in a hot tub in Mexico. 13 years, I could have a cigar. And sure as shit, I was smoking cigarettes again for 4 years and not able to stop. So, that working with that stuff is tough. And understanding that the judgment and condemnation that my mind is so caught up in doesn't help me. I always felt like it helped. Like if I grinded on myself and talked, you know, and I have that little voice, that critic, this idea of who I'm supposed to be, what's supposed to be, how I'm supposed to be. And it was very apparent to me one day, sober, 15 years, I don't know, I'd grabbed my gym bag, I grabbed a bunch of stuff from my car, I had my, and I went to get the mail because I didn't want to take another trip out to the mailbox. So I stick the mail under my arm, got my keys, and I'm walking up, and I stuck the key like that, and the mail fell down. And I thought, you're stupid. You're just, you know, I opened the thing, and as I'm opening the door, in my head, you're so dumb. Why don't you ever think you should put the mail in your mouth? That way, you wouldn't have had a problem. You know, I was going on and on, and I put the mail, I put it on the table. I'm going to take, you know, change my clothes, and I'm still on the mail. And then I stopped. And I said, that mail has been sitting on that table for 5 minutes. And I'm still on and on in my head about, and who cares? And I'm having again, these are one of these solo arguments with myself that I'm losing. And it's like, you know, you've got a problem. Like, loosen up. Lighten up. What is this grind, this endless grinding? And I think, you know, for me, it comes a lot from this sense of shame, guilt, and remorse. It comes from this idea of not being enough. It comes from, which help, you know, hinders my ability to feel worthy. And that's a lot of what drove my drinking and drove a lot of problems in my life relating with other people. And so Alcoholics Anonymous works, but it works slow. And one of the things I've got to do is do it, you know. I was told early on, and it's actually a version of this is in the book about the miner, but it's like somebody saying there's diamonds in the hills. You got to go up there and get a shovel. Well, okay, so I trust people, and I get my shovel, and I start digging, and I'm digging in this red clay, and I'm digging, and I'm digging a day after day, and I'm like, I don't see any diamonds, but they tell me they're here, so I'm going to keep digging, and I dig, and one day I hit the diamond. And it's like, it's true, you know, and it's exciting, that sense of like, I got, some, you know, this I didn't have, and now I have it, and this red clay is the greatest thing ever, and I start digging in the red clay, and another year later I get another diamond, I'm like, yes! I'm there, you know, I got it. So now I'm motivated, and I start digging, and then I hit blue clay. And it's like, oh, shit. It's over, right? Immediately, I think blue clay, bad. Red clay, good. Change, bad. Same, good. And, but I've got a habit now. I've been digging for years, so now I start digging in the blue clay. Pretty soon, month later, bam, diamond. Dig again, bam, another month, another diamond. Diamond, diamond, month, diamond. Green clay, bad, it's all over, shit. The blue clay was so awesome, now I've got this green clay. This sucks. But I got to have it. Digging the green clay, a week later, diamond. Another week, diamond, diamond. You know, purple clay is a diamond a day. This sucker, this AA thing for me is like literally a diamond a moment. That's what happens. But at the start, there was a lot of digging with no diamonds. That's the truth. You know, the truth is, my first year of sobriety, I was crazier than a shithouse rat. And it didn't get better for about five. my experience is, the younger you show up to AA, the more sick you are. So good luck with that. Also, my experience is, there's nowhere else to go. You're screwed. You know, really, if you are, you show up at AA at 15, 18, 20, 22, you're this is a lifelong deal. There's, you know, you can pretend, you know, but you could, if you got a dog and you call the tail a leg, the dog still got four legs. So, and don't get me wrong, there's nothing I love more than a newcomer with a plan. It's like my favorite thing. I love it. And what I love most is when they start telling me after they've been, you know, that they got 9 months or, you know, they get that itch that, I call it the fourth step itch. That's that unwillingness to look at what's really going on. And they're not, you know, poster boy of the meeting for the first month anymore. And not everyone's, you know, oh, 30 days. But after a while, there's some work to do here. It's called the steps. And you can avoid it for a while. I did. But there comes a point, you know, there are meetings in L.A. where they have a green, the white chips, the surrender chip, the yellow chips, the you're in the right place chip. I don't know. Anyway. But the green chip, they call it the go or grow chip. That's the nine-month chip. For me, it hit me at 8 months. And I was called out by two bulimic teenage girls named Nancy, who was skinny, blonde-haired Nancy and fat, black-haired Nancy. And that was my crowd. I hung out with bulimic teenage girls from the rehab. And old ladies. Those are the only people that didn't threaten me. You know, I got to Alcoholics Anonymous at 21 years old. I was really scared. I was very frustrated with myself. I tried to quit drinking for months until I quit. I'd quit trying to drink for months. And finally, you know, I realized I can't not drink. I mean, everybody in my family drinks, all my friends drink. I love drinking. You know, I've got a lot of problems, and I can't. I'm so tired of telling myself I'm not going to drink on Sunday afternoon after I've been drinking all weekend, and then Monday, Tuesday, you know, because I had a schedule. When I first started drinking, it was weekends. It was Fridays and Saturdays. Then it was Friday, Saturday, Sunday with football. Then it was Monday night at the pub. Then it was Thursday night at the Soak. And so I had a whole schedule. And if you told me the time of day or the week, I could tell you where I'd be. Friday at noon, I'd be eating burgers with beer. And then we go to pizza and beer later after the workout. And then, you know, I mean, I had a whole schedule of my drinking. So and I love drinking. And if I could drink 365 days a year like I like to drink, I would never, ever, ever have showed up at an AA meeting. Ever. I love drinking. I love partying. I love throwing my beer on people. I love everything. You know, I love everything about drinking. And you know how when you get to drinking, you start feeling like you're 6 foot five, 280 pounds? That's where I start. You know? And I really couldn't care. And the honest truth, I was at a party, and I was standing next to this chick and this guy's football guy girlfriend, boyfriend, and I was drinking punch out of the, you know, we had the big voodoo punch or whatever you call that thing, witch's brew, everyone pours the white alcohol. Anyway, I had a cup of red punch, and I got bored, you know? So I just threw my drink on her. And she said, "You asshole." I'm like, "What?" I didn't do anything. And I'm standing holding an empty punch cup in my hand. I told myself I wasn't going to do this, but I'll do. All right. So Halloween. Halloween is really my favorite holiday. It's just the best. You get to be somebody you're not, and so I always plan my holidays. I mean, my Halloween. I started my Halloween costume planning like in August. And so this one time I was dressed up. This is in college. I was dressed up as a streaker, you know, with the big, with the thing. And I mean, not a streaker, a flasher. A streaker. Because I had my coat, because it was the, you know, that's the reveal. It's all about the bam. So, but the point is, a friend of mine, a guy in my fraternity, Eric, walked up to me, and he was dressed as a pile of trash. So he's got, you know, crap all over him, is stapled to his shirt. He's got this huge turban of toilet paper, and which is funny. I thought, a pile of trash, that's good. So I took a cigarette out and lit my cigarette and then lit his turban on fire. And, you know, he's rolling around on the ground like this, trying to put it out. And the people are looking at me like I'm crazy. And I threw my beer on him and walked away. This is the truth. When I got sober, he lived in Seattle, and I had this whole make amends thing. And now direct amends. This is important because that I'm sober is a miracle. And Richard Zinni told me the only reason I'm sober is because I'm honest, and I was honest because I didn't really do anything right other than go to AA and read the material. I was so scared of who I was or who I thought you thought I was or who I thought I was supposed to be that I wasn't. I was just tormented by these thoughts. You know, I was in therapy for 7 years sober before I was able to come out and accept that I was gay. That was really tough for me. And I know that the reason sexual misconduct or sexual issues is part of the fourth step is because so many of us are troubled by this. We'd hardly be human if we, you know, didn't have sex troubles, right? So, and the trouble is not that I'm gay. There's no trouble with that. That's as normal as being straight. But the trouble was my inability to accept that I was gay. That was the trouble. So, but this drove a lot of my conflict, you know. And in the end, what I found out through therapy was that I had an idea who I thought I was, and I had an idea who I thought I was supposed to be. And sometimes these things would get close. You know, I'd win an award, or I'd have somebody, you know, do something right, and then I'd think the idea who I think I am is very close to the idea who I think I'm supposed to be, and I'd feel good about myself, and, you know, we'd have a party, or my mom would take me to dinner, or my parents would be proud. You know, and as I drank, of course, those things got further apart. But whether I'm drinking or sober, I'm no less tormented by this idea who I think I am and this idea who I think I'm supposed to be. In between the distance of that is my suffering. Sometimes who I think I am and who I think I'm supposed to be is close. Maybe I'm doing a lot of service work in AA. Maybe I just quit smoking or I'm eating better and then I feel good about myself. But then, you know, I turn on the internet and the porn's on there. Darn! Uncomfortable silence. So, and now all of a sudden this idea who I think I am is way over the ear, you know, far away from who I think I'm supposed to be. And I'm, tormented and judgmental until I finally got the picture through a lot of meditation and a lot of AA and a lot of talking that the idea who I think I'm supposed to be is horseshit. And no less the idea who I think I am is horseshit. Doesn't need to be either of those things. The idea who I think I'm supposed to be or the idea who I think I am, they don't really exist. What exists is this. And it's perfect. With no judgment and no suffering. Freedom. That was AA. So, sometimes I also realize that my best ideas aren't so good. And that just because I can doesn't mean I should. Sounds like Dr. Seuss. I wanted to make sure I got it to. And I'm here, so it's good. So, at my 20-year sobriety, my sobriety date is November 6, 1988. Ronald Reagan was still president, which is kind of scary. It was at the end of his presidency. Yeah, scary because he was still president, but scary. and in fact, the last drunken argument I got in was about Jesse Jackson and Michael Dukakis. And I know. Why are we even arguing about those guys? But the argument was, I don't know, because I was in a 5-hour blackout. But I found out later, the next morning, I used to eat beer cereal. Beer cereal is right as Chex Mix with beer. And I was with a bunch of guys eating beer cereal. And this guy, Brian... it's got doodads, it's got peanuts... this guy, Brian, is in my face. I just woke up. I don't know if you've ever been really hungover. This is a whole group of fraternity guys. We're out camping. I mean, I was drinking all day long. And that night I'd been, I don't know if anyone remembers the comedian Elmo or Emo, the guy with the sideways, I had the sideways wig on and I'm running up to people out on the beach just accosting them and being Emo. But anyway, and not Emo like 90s Emo, but Emo, the comedian from the 80s. Anyway. I'm so sad. I'd kill myself, but I just don't care enough. So I'm hungover. I'm trying to eat I'm trying to eat. I'm like just trying to like get my thing together. You know, start again. And this guy Brian's in my face going, "If you think I'm wrong, you're wrong. If you think I'm wrong, you're wrong." I'm like, "If you think I'm wrong, you're wrong." He says. And I'm like, what the what the hell are you talking about? He's like, if you think I'm wrong, you're wrong. I'm like, what are you saying? What are, you know, I'm like, just woke up. What are you? He's like, for 5 hours last night, that's all you said when we were arguing. If you think I'm wrong, you're wrong. I was like, that's a good argument. That's solid. That's solid. There's no way around that. I got that. You know, and the reality was, that's how I thought. In all things in life, if you think I'm wrong, you're wrong. You know, the corollary, I heard it this morning, the corollary was, I'd agree with you, but that would mean both of us were wrong. You know, that's the kind of flip side of that. Yeah, and confrontational. So, you know, that was in October. I ended up, through a series of events, I had gone to an AA meeting with a friend. This guy had gotten in a lot of trouble, shaved his head, wrote an apology letter and blood to his girlfriend on the wall, was, you know, sentenced to AA from the college. Today he'd be arrested. But I agreed to go to this meeting. The only guy I knew at that meeting was a friend of a friend of mine. I knew George partied. I didn't know Eric, but I knew Eric was George's roommate. And so, you know, you can trust a guy like George to only hang out with other people that are drug addicts. And in fact, Eric had disappeared. He'd gone to rehab. George had helped him and sponsored him. I didn't know any of this. But the fact was that on the worst day of my life, after a weekend of laying in bed thinking I have to kill myself, but I'm too scared, that Friday I had grabbed the Yellow Pages. I'd had the phone in my hand. I'd looked up AA. And I took the phone and I threw it against the wall and I took the Yellow Pages and I threw back that we didn't have cell phones. We had Yellow Pages. And I threw those against the wall and I laid in bed and listened to Pink Floyd on repeat. I had a CD player and I listened to The Wall for 2 days. Did you know the end of that and the start of that actually are the same note? You'll actually, if you ever do that, it just goes one into the other. Just, I think they planned that. But anyway, the only guy I ran into was on a spiral staircase. I was going to class and I was late. I saw nobody on the way over to class. The entire walk over there, people in the morning on Monday morning are either in a sleeping or in the cafeteria. And again, I was walking to this class late. Now it turned out that I actually attended a class for an entire semester that I wasn't even enrolled in. But you know, that's a different story. Situational awareness. Anyway, so I'm on this staircase and out of the blue, and I'm, you know, when you're really grinding, I mean, like nothing else exists, just me in my head, and I hear, hey big guy, how's it going? And I look up and around and it's this guy Eric, or Mark, who is at the top of the stairs. And I said, not so good. Now I did not say I've been thinking about killing myself all weekend. I didn't say that I think, you know, I'm failing out of college. I'm $250,000 in debt. I'm probably going to be in prison. I didn't say all the things that were going on. I said, not too good. That's alcoholic. Not too good. And he said, and I said, are you going to one of those AA meetings tonight? He said, yeah, I'm going tonight. I said, would you take me? He said, yes. November 6, 1988. The miracle was that at 7 o'clock, I was at the stop sign on 6th and College where I said I'd be for him to pick me up. But I did that because I was desperate. Now, at that time, I thought desperate was enough. But I've come to learn that desperate is necessary but not sufficient. It's not enough to be desperate in AA. You've got to do the work. You've got to be motivated. You have to be able to stand in the face of your own pride and your own fear and find the courage from the people around us to do it. And to do it means to tell the truth. To do it means to show up and be a service. To do it means to give when it's a pain in the ass. That's the do it part. So I went to this meeting, and it was months later. I was about 4 months sober the first time I saw somebody get a cake for 23 years. First time somebody got real time. You know, I mean, over 20 years. The guy's name, he stood outside and talked to me prior to the meeting. He was listening, because of course, for him, I'm like a fire and he's a Boy Scout warming his hands up on this new guy who's just got full of trouble, right? He's like, tell me more. Tell me, oh, you got problems? Tell me, oh, yeah, this is horrible. I didn't realize later he's living vicariously through my suffering. That's all good. you know, but he told me his kid was having problems and he had gotten a divorce and, you know, but then we sit down and they do this, you know, this cake thing and they say, now to Eric, 23 years. And I'm like, that's bullshit. And in my head, and I, honest to this day, I don't know. I think I actually stood up and said something in the meeting because it was a small meeting and that's my way. I would have done that. But I can't promise you. But I, either in my head or for real, I said, that's a bunch of crap. He was just telling me about all the problems he has out there. I don't believe him. You know, because that's how I felt. There's impossible. 23 years. A liar. It's impossible. Well, you know, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, I got a 20-year cake. And as I was getting this cake, I talked about that story and just the disbelief that someone could stay sober 20 years. And then I tried to, you know, and I remember in that meeting, sitting there thinking, as soon as I kind of surrendered, listened to him talk about his time, I remember thinking to myself, I'm 21, what would my life be like? I'd be 41, oh, I'd probably have a car and a wife and that, you know, trying to conceive of what my life would be like, which wouldn't be just totally in the toilet. And, you know, as I recounted that story, and then I talked about my life in the last 20 years, at the meeting when I got my cake, how impossible, beyond my comprehension, beyond conception, at 21 years old, to understand what my life would be like at 21. That I would go through a war and stay sober. That I would get married and divorced. That I would be able to have a job and be to win Teacher of the Year, to travel all over the world. You know, I mean, to do all the things that I did, but mostly to have the sense of peace and comfort and sense of self that I had. To not be tortured by my mind. It's like beyond belief. And as I went to sit down, literally at between here and here, so there's no thinking. I don't know if you ever sat. There's no thinking here to here. But as I was sitting down, this thought just slammed in my head. What if the next 20 years are as beyond your comprehension as the previous 20? Of course, I thought, that's impossible. I'm too smart. I know AA, blah, blah, blah. And my mind started to argue, but then I thought, what if it really is beyond? What if I couldn't conceive of the next 20 years? And what if they were just as incredible and miraculous as the previous 20, but better? Well, at my 25th anniversary, at that point, I had changed jobs to a better job. I had gotten married to a guy that I'd been dating for 5 years. We just celebrated a year together, and Anthony, you're the light of my life. And I love you so much. You really... you've been a tremendous support for me. And that 5 years later, my life is already beyond what I could have conceived of at 20 years sober. So, you know, what I wanted to make sure I did today for the people that are new or for the people that have 5 years or 7 years or 10 years, and maybe for the people that have 30 years, that AA is, that you can't outgrow it. You can't outdo it. And the last thing I'll say is this. I was a year, 12 months sober. I was in Indianapolis at stationed at Fort Bend in a training before I went into the Gulf War. And there's a meeting there, and there was a guy named Bodo Schick, and I saw this guy Bodo who, when he got his one-year cake, he had like a glow about him. And he talked about it being, took him 5 years to get the 1 year. And I just remember thinking to myself, there's something special about this guy. And then he told me that he sold his Harley in order to pay for his daughter's birth for the hospital bills. I thought, this guy is awesome. I love this guy. So I hung out with Bodo, and he's like, well, you got to go to this men's meeting Tuesday night at this Alano Club. And I was like, I hate men's meetings. I don't go there. I like old ladies and bulimic teenage girls. That's my crowd. He's like, no, dude, you got to go to this meeting. I'm like, dude, I'm not fucking going to no men's meeting. I hate those things. Everyone's an asshole there. You know, and the fact was, I went around these men's meetings and just thought, are you my father? I hate you. Are you my father? I hate you. So he's like, dude, I'll go with you. We'll go have dinner after. I'm like, okay, I'll go. I hate this. So I go to the meeting, and at the end, you know, I throw down the hands and start racing for the door like any new guy in AA, and this old guy steps in front of me. And he goes, you're new here, aren't you? Why do you think that? Oh. And he says, son, Welcome to A. Do you know the name of this meeting? And I'm like, no. And I'm trying to like get around him, and he's just kind of standing there. And he's, I go, no, I don't know. He said, this name of this group is the Cold Nickel Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm thinking, great old man, get out of my fucking way. And then he says, do you know why this, and he talks slow. Old people are slow. He's like, do you know why this meeting's called the Cold Nickel Group of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I remember at that moment, just that internal surrender, like he's not going to, you know, he's obviously, no, old man, I don't know why this meeting is called the Cold Nickel Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, because AA is the million-dollar education shoved up your ass one cold nickel at a time. And then he stepped aside. So if you're new, you just got a nickel's worth. And I'd like to thank you guys again. Thank you.